Anti-intellectualism can range from simple indifference towards education or intellectual curiosity to a general skepticism of knowledge, especially the sense that common sense is just good enough and people don't really need to be too educated to understand the world or to make money.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum here in Harvard Square. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight, in what some might consider rather doleful times for the country, we are going to consider the idea of American exceptionalism with author and Stanford Law Fellow Mugambi Dewey. Dewey has just published a book entitled Exceptional America, and in it he delves into the concept behind the word exceptional with its various ramifications. What has exceptionalism come to mean, both in our current climate of rhetorical newspeak and also in our country's historical parlance? Is America standing out or missing out? In his new book, Dewey looks at why Americans are more divided than other Westerners over basic issues, including wealth inequality, healthcare, climate change, evolution, gun control, mass incarceration, and abortion. Is America becoming more polarized, he asks, and does American exceptionalism explain these social changes? In seeking to understand these recent developments, Dewey dissects the body of American thinking that has produced President Donald Trump. I'm pleased to introduce Mugambi Dewey.
So in the first part of my talk, I explained the origins of the phrase American exceptionalism and how the intense polarization of America is a dimension of what it's historically meant, namely that America is an exception, especially within the Western world. In the second part, I want to focus on the root causes of what political scientists have called asymmetric polarization, which is, again, an empirical phenomenon indicating that over the last 30 years or so, the Republican Party has moved significantly more to the right then the Democratic Party has moved to the left. In particular, in my book, Exceptional America, I identify four factors as part of a nexus of polarization. The first is profound anti-intellectualism. Second is fervent Christian fundamentalism. Third is a visceral suspicion of government. And the fourth is racial resentment. Combined together, they contribute to forging an anti-rational, hardline ideology that is very hostile to compromise. The first factor in this nexus is the extraordinary weight of anti-intellectualism in parts of American society. Anti-intellectualism can range from simple indifference towards education or intellectual curiosity to a downright hostility against the learned. But more generally, it refers to a general skepticism of knowledge, especially the sense that common sense is just good enough and people don't really need to be too educated to understand the world or to make money. This mindset did not begin with modern-day politicians like Donald Trump, Sarah Palin, or George W. Bush, who have an unmistakably anti-intellectual style. In fact, this aspect of polarization is largely traceable to admirable dimensions of American exceptionalism and American history, including from the very beginning. It's important to understand that America was the first Western democracy to emerge from the Enlightenment. The American Revolution of 1776 preceded the French Revolution of 1789. And with the birth of American democracy came an egalitarian spirit. Now, of course, there were glaring contradictions, ranging from the cruelties of African slavery to the persecution of Native Americans to the disenfranchisement of women in a firmly patriarchal society, but it was an egalitarian spirit nonetheless. And as the historian Richard Hofstadter explains, This egalitarian spirit fostered a populist conception of democracy that started equating education with elitism, perceiving education as a badge of the ruling class and the pseudo-aristocracy, and that fostered the notion that people really don't need to be too educated because common sense is just good enough. Ironically, many of the founding fathers of the United States were intellectuals, men of the Enlightenment, polymath, highly cultured, very well read. Some, like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, even engaged in scientific experiments. Yet, the politicians today, who are often the most inclined to invoke the heritage of the founding fathers, are often also, paradoxically, among the most anti-intellectual. And anti-intellectualism contributes to the extraordinary polarization of American society because it fosters ignorance, gullibility, receptiveness to conspiracy theories, and more generally, a skepticism of education. And overall, today, notwithstanding the rise of far-right European parties, conspiracy theories, disinformation, naked propaganda are much more common in the US political system, and they have been for quite a long time. The second factor in this nexus of polarization is the weight of Christian fundamentalism in parts of American society. Fundamentalism goes beyond mere religious conservatism because millions of Christian conservatives throughout the world do not interpret the Bible literally. According to data, between a third and 40% of Americans are creationists, who think that human beings were created by God in their present form and that the theory of evolution is false. A similar proportion believe in apocalyptic biblical prophecies about the imminent return of Jesus Christ. These types of beliefs are very rare within the modern Western world, except in America. And within America, they are primarily concentrated in conservative America. However, another substantial proportion of Americans lean towards liberal or moderate conceptions of Christianity. And that calls into question the conventional wisdom that America today is mainly polarized between believers and non-believers. Yes, the number of non-believers has risen in recent years, so has the number of people who are not affiliated with a church. And yet, it's important to note that, especially by the standards of the modern Western world, non-believers are a limited proportion of the American population. And that the main divide is among people of faith, especially between Christian fundamentalists who have historically resisted modernity and liberal or moderate Christians who have embraced it. The weight of Christian fundamentalism in American society has been shaped by different facets of American exceptionalism, including the fact that Americans have not experienced as long a history of religious conflict and clerical domination as Europeans did in pre-modern times. As a result, Americans have become less suspicious of organized religions, not seeing them oftentimes as social institutions, and often seeing religions as mere means of worship or self-help, which has enabled radical conceptions of Christianity to develop in certain parts of the country with limited critical analysis. Today, Christian fundamentalism does not only shape very hardline positions on theological questions, it also tends to shape hardline positions on social policy matters, such as abortion, contraception, and gay rights. But beyond that, it also shapes a hardline, anti-rational, anti-intellectual, black and white, authoritarian mindset that extends way beyond religious questions. And that is part of the reason why many Christian fundamentalists have strongly identified with Donald Trump's movement. After all, he does not appear to be particularly religious, even though he says that the Bible is his favorite book, alongside The Art of the Deal. And another part of the reason why Christian fundamentalists identify with Donald Trump's movement is that they support his agenda, such as on denying the reality of climate change, expelling undocumented immigrants, or repealing the Affordable Care Act, Obama's health care reform. But it's also worth noting that the extraordinary weight of Christian fundamentalism is, again, in sharp contrast with the views of many founding fathers who often were skeptical of Christian dogma. The third factor in this nexus of polarization is the visceral suspicion of government in parts of American society, especially the rise in the last 30 years of what the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz has called free market fundamentalism, which is a notion that big government, taxes, and regulation are the causes of virtually all economic problems. This mindset is very atypical within the modern Western world, including among conservatives, except in the United States. And within America, it also is atypical, even though it existed in earlier periods of American history and was quite prevalent, in fact, before Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal socioeconomic model. Today, America is the only modern Western democracy without a universal healthcare system. And universal healthcare is also accepted in other parts of the developed world, such as Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. And in these other developed nations, it tends to be accepted by both liberals and conservatives. Even far-right European political parties tend to argue that universal healthcare is great, but it's for our people, not for immigrants. And that is a big part of the reason why Obama's relatively limited healthcare reform proved extraordinarily controversial in the United States. However, there was a time when both liberals and conservatives in America were in greater agreement about economic issues, especially after Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal economic model proved widely popular. In fact, Dwight Eisenhower did not have a fundamental quarrel with many New Deal programs. And it's also worth noting that the top income tax rate under Eisenhower was approximately 90%, whereas under Obama during his first term, it was approximately 35%, and that rose to 39% during his second term, even though Obama was accused of raising income taxes to all-time highs. And that is where this aspect of the nexus connects to another one, which is the weight of anti-intellectualism and conspiracy mongering. Because falsehoods about tax hikes that never occurred, about the hoax of climate change, play a significant role in driving people to hate the US federal government. And many of these conspiracy theories are supported or promoted by moneyed interests, such as the oil industry, thereby reflecting another dimension of American exceptionalism, which is that it's the Western nation where lobbying has the most influence over democracy. And that's contributed to making America the Western nation with by far the sharpest degree of wealth inequality. But this is also a historic reversal, because there was an age when America was more equal socioeconomically. And it also connects to the other nexus of Christian fundamentalism, because a lot of evidence indicates that many of the people who are market fundamentalists also happen to be Christian fundamentalists, because there are ideological parallels in how to think about religion and the economy, and tend to have very hardline views that stress ideological purity. The last part of the nexus of polarization is the weight of racial resentment in American society. This is the part of the nexus that is closest to what we see in Europe with the rise of far-right political parties that have a very nativist anti-immigrant agenda. However, it's also worth noting that America still is very different in this area due to yet another dimension of American exceptionalism, which is that America has historically been the Western democracy with by far the highest proportion of racial and ethnic minorities. Today, there are approximately 38%. That is much more than in Western European nations. And it's always been that way. And therefore, racial divisions have played a much bigger role in shaping American history and institutions. Think of the US Civil War, the US Civil Rights Movement, the clashes over the status and the rights of African Americans that played such a big role in American history. Now, sure, European nations had slavery and they had colonies, but these were largely in remote continents, in the Americas, Africa, Asia, and beyond. And there were few people of color in European nations until the rise of immigration from former colonies in the post-World War II era. As a result, European institutions like universal healthcare were created long before the current immigration crisis. And Europeans start to think of programs like universal healthcare not as something primarily for minorities or for immigrants, but as something for them, for the average person. Whereas in America, many of the people who vote against their self-economic interest are very hostile to universal healthcare or public assistance programs as a whole, because they tend to think that these are primarily handouts for Black people, for Latinos, for undocumented immigrants, rather than something for them. And this is where that connects as well to another factor in the nexus, the weight of anti-intellectualism and conspiracy mongering, because many of people's views about these matters are shaped by propaganda, such as the notion that Obamacare is primarily a handout for Black people on welfare, which is what many of the law's opponents claimed or insinuated, such as Rush Limbaugh, who claimed that Obamacare is reparations for slavery. These types of racial divisions have played a much less significant role in the history of Western European nations, especially in the last 50 years. So there you have it, the four factors in the nexus of polarization: profound anti-intellectualism, fervent Christian fundamentalism, a visceral suspicion of government, and racial resentment. All of these dimensions of American exceptionalism are themselves shaped by other dimensions of American exceptionalism, starting with the very beginning of American history and admirable traits of this country, including the fact that it was the first Western democracy to emerge from the Enlightenment. These factors seem to have old roots, even as they take on new forms. And much of this appears to be cyclical. All these tensions have contributed to making America a land of striking contradictions. Consider how today the United States is the Western democracy where creationism and skepticism of climate science have by far the most weight, but how it's also one of the nations that's done the most to promote the spread of science, and how Americans were the first people on the moon. Consider how the United States is the Western democracy where clashes over reproductive rights and women's rights are often the most vigorous. And yet, how American suffragettes and trailblazers were among the pioneers internationally for women's rights, and how the birth control pill that played a big role in the sexual revolution was invented by American scientists. Consider how America was the first, and only so far, Western democracy to ever elect a person of color as its head of state. And how 8 years later, it elected a man who claimed that his predecessor was not really American because he probably had a forged U.S. birth certificate. All these fascinating, intriguing, striking contradictions are also what make America an exceptional country for better or worse. Thank you.
You are listening to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square as we continue our examination of exceptional America with author and Stanford Law Fellow, Mugambi Jue. In your article, The Mother Jones piece, you talked about how Trump morphed his slogan from making America number one again to making America great again. What did he imply by great?
Donald Trump's slogan, make America great again, was not fundamentally new. Such slogans had been used by, say, Ronald Reagan, but it also tends to mirror what the Republican establishment had been saying for years, accusing Obama of betraying American exceptionalism and heritage of the founding fathers. So this was essentially a rebranding of the strategy of the Republican establishment to accuse Obama of betraying American values and vowing to make America great again. But of course, as I mentioned during my presentation, Donald Trump went one step further in suggesting that Obama not only lacked American values, but also that he lacked an American identity because he supposedly lacked a valid U.S. Birth certificate, which would have made him an undocumented immigrant.
Okay, well, anyone like to pose questions, please come up to the microphone.
My question, I guess there's so many things, is just I'm always action-oriented, so I'm wondering what I can do other than trying to get people to read your book. What do you think we can do?
It would be great if Americans could learn to live with each other more, to not live in a balkanized society. American liberals should make efforts to befriend American conservatives, and notwithstanding profound disagreements over fundamental questions. In my time living in America, I've lived in many different regions of the country. I've known people with all sorts of political and religious beliefs, and oftentimes we profoundly disagreed, but we still respected each other as human beings, and we learned from each other's perspectives. And this is what people can do. Perhaps it will not have an immediate solution, but at least it will lead us to avoid demonizing each other.
Thank you for a profoundly depressing presentation. But I do have two questions. You talked a bit about propaganda and conspiracy theories. And I wonder if you would speak a little bit more about the role of the media in supporting the four factors that produce polarization. And then I wish you would talk a little bit more about that one little ray of hope you mentioned. This is a cyclical process. How has America got out of some of the depths of know-nothingism in the past? And do you see anything, aside from individual conversations, that we might pursue in the future?
With regard to the media, I describe in my book how the surge of wealth inequality in the United States also mirrored the growing deregulation of the media industry and the shift of many news organizations away from simply informing people in a thoughtful manner towards entertainment. Many started favoring soft news over hard news. And also there was the growth of a balkanized media and hyperpartisan media such as Fox News, which has played a role in promoting disinformation in many ways. At least there are empirical studies finding that it plays a disproportional role in this area. Now, with regard to the second part of your question about where do we go from here, the main difficulty is not only that there's a big divide over Americans' values, that there's also a factual divide. And it's very hard to have a rational debate about solutions to any given problem if people tend to be very divided about whether there's a problem at all. So, for example, if someone thinks that climate change is a hoax invented by know-it-all scientists, it's not possible to have a debate about how to resolve that issue. And even when there's agreement, say, about the need to improve the American economy, Americans are also very divided about the means of how to do so. Many Americans on the left think that the way to revive the American dream is for the government to play a more active role in promoting wealth and equality and favoring access to healthcare and redistributing wealth, etc. Whereas many American conservatives think the exact opposite, that the way to revive the American dream is to practically eviscerate the role of government in all aspects of the economy. And that seems, at this stage, an unbridgeable gap. However, a lot of this appears to be part of historical cycles. There were periods, as I mentioned, where a more egalitarian socioeconomic model was accepted by both liberals and conservatives, say after Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal model, and that may happen again in the future. It's also worth noting, since we talked about how Europeans sometimes perceive America, Europeans often are very critical of the excesses of American capitalism and of the magnitude of wealth inequality in America, but many of them point to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal as a way of resolving Europe's economic problems and creating more equal economic societies. And America is often perceived as a model of what not to do and of what to do abroad.
So basically you're saying we need to wait for another voice, a Franklin Roosevelt, a Martin Luther King, somebody who will speak to everybody above and beyond those divides.
Well, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future, as the popular saying goes, but the aim of my book is mainly to try and explain how America got there. There are certainly policies that would be in the greater good, such as abandoning mass incarceration, moving towards a universal healthcare system, more reasonable gun control, and there are many different ways of trying to get there. And we'll have to see how society evolves. Thank you.
I'd just like to thank Mugambi Jue for coming all the way from Stanford to take part in the forum. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to part two of Exceptional America, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square in May 2017 with author and Stanford Law Fellow Mugambi Jue. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us, and do come again.